Okay. Afternoon. We have a public hearing. It is on the proposed issuance by the county of its airport bond anticipation notes 2021 Series A, subject to the alternatives minimum tax in the appropriate aggregate principal amount of $13 million, the Series A notes. The proceeds from the sale of Series A notes will, one, finance the current refunding of the county's $10 million airport bond anticipation notes 2020 Series A, subject to the alternative minimum tax, the 2020 Series A notes, the proceeds of which were used to finance a capital improvement project, known as a project going forward at the county's existing Ithaca-Tompkins Regional Airport, the airport, located at 1 Culligan Drive, Ithaca, New York, 14850. 2, finance the current refunding of the county's $3 million airport bond anticipation notes 2020 Series C, subject to the alternative minimum tax, the 2020 Series C notes, the proceeds of which were used to provide new monies for the project, and 3, pay all or a portion of the cost incidental to the issuance of Series A notes, including issuance cost of the Series A notes. The project consists of additions, renovations, and improvements, including an expansion to the facility's existing terminal building, apron reconstruction, installation of a new passenger boarding bridge, installation of a geothermal heating and cooling system, installation of overhead canopies with solar panels to be located in the existing public parking lot, installation of additional solar panels on the top of the existing curbside canopy, the construction of a new federal customs facility, and the relocation of the existing aviation fuel facility currently located east of Klein Boulevard on the property of the airport to a proposed shared-use fuel facility site located east of Warren Road, also on airport property, all to include site, access and parking improvements, demolition, utility, mechanical, plumbing, and electrical improvements, the acquisition of original furnishings, fixtures, and equipment, and payment of professional fees, and all other necessary costs incidental to such work. The county is the owner and operator of the airport. And the public hearing is opened on that proposal. Anyone here to speak to that public hearing? Seeing no one, I will close.
Well, fine. We normally don't speak as legislators on public hearing, but since there's no one else, I would just like to mention there's a wasp on my paper, but that list that you just read of the bonding that we're talking about, the projects that we're talking about with the money that has been filed here, is pretty amazing if you think about it. It's the airport terminal, the passenger bridges, the geothermal heating, the solar energy installations that are there, to mention a few. This is a project the county has been working on with its Air Services Board, with its airport administration, Director Mike Hall, with our administration, Jason Molino, and others. for a number of years. And it is a, it has brought our airport into the 21st century. The amount of funding that we have received from the state and other, other sources have been, has been exemplary. It hasn't been cheap. We didn't expect the pandemic to hit us, this year, naturally, and cause us a setback in the number of flights that we were going to have. But for the long term, this is going to be a wonderful thing for us. And I want to thank all the people, going back to those who originally started lobbying and writing grant applications for the terminal project and others for this pretty important project. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, for speaking to it. Anyone else to speak? Ann Corman, are you speaking to public hearing? Oh, no. Anna Kellis, speaking to the public hearing.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up something that has come up recently that I want to clarify specifically for the public. I know a lot of us have been in support of the airport becoming international, which required, you know, the customs.
Anna, it's really hard to hear you.
Can you hear me better now?
A little.
I am not sure why I might have to sign out and sign back in, but I will lean in close so you can hear me. I did just want to briefly talk about some comments that I've seen continuing about the customs facility, and specifically in about an event that happened on Election Day, one of the early voting election days and Election Day. Because of the way things are set up, we have a customs officer that will be the personnel at the customs facility. And they come from Syracuse, and that is something that that I think people in the community don't know. So they have to drive from Syracuse to Ithaca and back again whenever there is an expected flight. They will be driving in a marked vehicle, it was the fear. The vehicle is a customs vehicle, and it says customs on it. But the fear that spread was that it was an ICE vehicle. My understanding from what I've seen is, when ICE comes to town, they don't necessarily, market it, with a big sign on the side of their vehicle. So when people see this marked vehicle at the airport, it is specifically for the customs facility and the person who is coming commuting from Syracuse. So I just wanted to clarify that because I saw that there was concern, and I wanted people to know that we as legislators are maintaining vigilance about this. We take their concerns really seriously. I personally take their concerns very seriously. I know my colleagues do as well. So education, you know, on this, I think, is really important. Just wanted to make that point clear.
Okay. All right, I will move to close the public hearing on that proposal and open the public hearing on a second proposal, which is proposed local law C of 2020, a local law amending section 205 and section 209 of Article 2 of the Tompkins County Charter. Public hearing is opened. Are there any comments on this proposal? I see no public commenting on it. All right, I will close the public hearing on this one. Bam, it is closed. And open the December 1st, 2020, meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call of members.
Shauna Black.
Here.
Amanda Champion?
Here.
Deborah Dawson?
Here.
Henry Granison?
Present.
Rich John?
Here.
Anna Kellis?
Here.
Dan Klein?
Here.
Ann Corman?
Present.
Mike Lane?
Here.
Dave McKenna?
Here.
Glenn Morey?
Here.
Martha Robertson?
Here.
Mike Sigler?
Here.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Present.
14 members present.
Thank you very much. We have no proclamations today, and you would have received any communications or notices in your mailboxes or via email. We will have an executive session this evening for the purposes of discussing personnel matters related to a particular person. Now we move on to privilege of the floor for the public. I have one written correspondence that came to us. I will read into the record, submitted by Travis Nevins, subject local labor and the IDA. To the legislature and the public, my name is Travis Nevins, and I work with the Painters and Allied Trades Union. I'm also a resident of Ithaca. I'm very excited about some of the conversations that have been had recently regarding the case report and the recommendations made within that report. I hope that all of the legislators will consider the recommendations in the case report for future policy. In regards to the content involving the IDA, I believe that Tompkins County has done a great job attracting developers to the area. This is evident as we look at all the developments popping up. That said, I think that we can do more for the community and the local workforce. I believe that the IDA can increase the amount of local workers on these projects without scaring off developers. The first step to this process is to include local labor in the discussion. It is my understanding that the county legislators have the power to make appointments to the Tompkins County IDA. I ask that the county consider making labor an appointment to the IDA. I think that labor can bring knowledge and resources to the IDA if given a seat in the future. The labor reps that could assume such a role are cognizant of the challenges of the IDA that reach far past labor. If labor did get a chance to sit on the IDA, I want to let you know that it would be as a representative of the community just as much as labor. We are all in this together, and we, labor, recognize that labor is a small piece of the overall puzzle. I do not say this to discount the goals of labor, as we believe the value of a middle-class sustainable career are vitally important. I am saying this to let you know that the responsibilities that the county legislature and the IDA face are far-reaching and require careful thought and execution. This is not lost on me or my colleagues. In conclusion, I believe not having labor at the table when discussing upcoming developments is a disservice to the community, and I hope the county will consider appointing labor to the IDA to better accommodate the constituents of the county. Read into the record. Anyone else here to speak on the privilege of the floor for the public? Don't see anyone. Moving on to privilege of the floor for our municipal officials.
George is here.
George, yay.
Good afternoon and early evening, everyone.
Good afternoon, George.
Yes.
Okay. Before I start, I have a question about the airport. I'm unclear as to what kind of flights are international flights. Are those private flights or airline flights? What exactly are those planes that come to the International.
Yeah. Chair of F&I, Mike Lane, will give you a response.
Initially, we expect most of that will be private flights. They could be coming from as far away as Asia or Europe, coming into our fixed base operator portion of the airport. However, we would very much like to see perhaps the flights coming in from Canada. And remember, Canada is an international destination because it's a different country. Whether there would be anything beyond that in the future, we're hopeful, but those are the ideas that we have at present time. And that's the work that our administration at the airport has been working on.
Thanks, Mike. As far as city business, I don't really have much for you this evening. We meet tomorrow, Common Council does. Nothing's on the agenda, but there are some major development projects on the horizon, both in College Town and in the gully that Six Mile Creek comes down into downtown, and potentially on Tagannock Boulevard. But those are a ways off. The city received a grant, I believe from the federal government, to study changes on Route 13 between Purity Ice Cream and Day Street, a little past Day Street. So I think we're going to undertake this study, which would see if we could turn this into a more of a boulevard type of street with better pedestrian crossings, etc. And what else? There's another. We got a grant to fund the LEED program, which is kind of ancillary to the police department and drug issues. We haven't really figured out how we're going to incorporate that into action, but we're working on that. And last and probably least, we're going to vote on whether or not it will be legal to have dogs on the commons. So there you go.
Thank you, George. Any questions for George from legislators? Mike Sigler?
Do you have any idea how much that grant was for the Day Street Route 13 study?
Well, it's a 50-50 grant, and I think it's for up to about $2.5 million, but I don't think we have enough money to do the whole thing. So we're going to do about half of it, which should get us a good start. That's what we're voting on.
Oh, thanks.
All right. Martha, then Henry.
Thanks, Leslin. Hey, George. So this Route 13, is that like to actually design the new boulevard, or is that, because that sounds like a lot of money for not that much real estate.
That's an excellent question. I think it is design. It's not construction, but I think it's extensive design, and it would be looking at a number of perhaps new intersections and new ways to get across, and a meridian, like a grass meridian in the middle. So some significant changes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That grant for LEED, I think that was – Henry sent around some press. It was $900,000, I think.
Yep, it's a lot of money.
That's correct.
And is that for a few years? What's the time period?
3 years.
3 years.
So, Leslie, you kind of answered the question I wasn't sure I wanted to ask you in public, because in case the answer was no. But I thought you were working on that grant. It sounds like you were. Were you working on the grant?
Play the fit.
It's coming through GIAC.
Congratulations. That's really awesome. That's fantastic. Looking forward to seeing what's included and how we can participate and support it.
Thank you.
Henry?
Yes. Hi, George. How are you?
Hi, Henry.
I noticed with the Collinstown project, do you know what the time frame is on that? I know there's a meeting next week about it, but do you know the general time frame?
No, because what they're asking is way beyond what current zoning is. So I don't even know if they're asking for a PUD.
Right.
And I don't even know if that'll be approved in the present context of what they want.
Okay. Also, so is Dogs on the Common going to pass?
I'm going to vote against it, but it will pass, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, really? Why are you going to vote against
it? I told I can't think of her name. I can't believe it. A person who lives on the commons, who's been against Dogs on the Commons for many years. I told her I would support her and I'm not going to change my mind. I will say that,
George, did you meet Faye?
Yes, Faye. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Faye Gukakis. So I told Faye many times I would not support Dogs on the Commons. And I'm sticking to that. I'm pretty sure I'll be the only person who votes against it. I have seen I've seen dogs injure children like in the blink of an eye, nice dogs. And that's the main reason I'm going to vote against it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us, George, and thank you for reporting. George McGonigal, City of Ithaca Council, person representing the First Ward.
Thank you. You guys look good this evening. Handsome group.
We always look good.
We try. We put on our best suits. We try. And just, you know, real quickly, since George brought it up as well, a response to Martha, GIAC is involved with LEAD, and GIAC Deputy Director Travis Brooks is taking the lead on it. The lead on LEAD. Look at that. Representative of the floor for legislators, Dan Klein.
Thank you. We have something that the legislature's been doing for a while called the Distinguished Youth Award, and in recent times it's transformed a little bit. It's in partnership with Cayuga Radio Group. We used to bring the youth here, they would get to get a little speech and have a little presentation, but now, since everything's remote, the ceremony itself is happening at the Cayuga Radio Group. And I just want to mention that I was able to, I was honored to give some awards last week. So the two recipients were Avery Roberts of Groton and Jenna Goodwin of Newfield. And, it's nice to do some positive things. You know, as I said in my remark to them, that we in the legislature end up having to deal with a lot of kind of bad news, right? A lot of problems that's what we end up dealing with. But this was a nice positive thing to do. And I got to read their little bios, and it's very impressive what these young people are doing. It took me kind of twice that long to even get close to the things that they were doing. So I just wanted to publicly acknowledge them again, Avery Roberts and Jenna Good.
Yay, we can give them a hand. These folks are not here. And thank you, Dan, for doing that. I encourage all legislators, I've mentioned it before. You know, Kathy will let us know, because Kiyogari Duru is in touch with her, and we can definitely go up there and do that. So thank you, Dan, for doing it, for acknowledging our young people and the work that they have been doing. Shauna Black.
I just wanted to acknowledge the fact that we lost three of our residents at Oak Hill Manor Nursing Home over the past week from the COVID virus. We're definitely, on behalf of the legislature, we're very sorry for the family and loved ones that are surrounding. We also are thinking very much so of the staff that is infected with the COVID infection, as well as the other residents. We do hope that everyone feels better soon, and you are definitely in our thoughts. So I just wanted to pass that along.
Thank you, Shauna. Anyone else? Mike Lane.
We heard a letter read this afternoon about the IDA and the possibility of a appointment for a labor representative to the IDA. I was on the IDA for quite a number of years. I chaired it for a while. I want to say that in the past, we have not been deaf to issues of labor. Labor used to be at the meetings I chaired on a regular basis. We always turned to them for their input. Same with some other groups. Back then, it was the school districts that were lobbying us for a seat on the IDA, saying that, well, whatever you do is increasing the number of people that comes to our schools, and therefore it's costing us more money when you, for example, approve more apartments in downtown Ithaca. The there are good reasons to have different people on the IDA. I've thought about it recently again, having heard the folks that are lobbying for this. I think it's time that we increase the number of people on the IDA from 7 to 9, which would take state legislation, I believe, to do that. I've run this by our county attorney to get his thoughts on it. It's not that unusual. Each of these IDAs has apparently a separate state law that forms it. We have our own state law. Other IDAs, and Jonathan Wood mentioned to me, Seneca County has 9 people on its IDA. I think that would free up and give us an opportunity to think about if we wanted to add people who were from different groups or different people from the community onto the IDA. So I would like to see us consider that.
Thank you, Mike. Rich John.
Thanks, Mike, for bringing that up. As the chair of the IDA, I would say this is a worthy thing for us to talk about, both the addition of a labor seat and changing the number of members, which would be really optimal. I think that discussion we should have. We're going to be meeting, I believe, a week from tomorrow, and I will make sure this gets on our agenda. So thanks for doing the homework on that, Mike.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Rich. Anna Kellis?
Yeah, thank you for you both. I'll add my voice to that and just an update. And Rich, thank you for pointing out, you know, there are two issues. One is the labor seat and one is the expansion of the number of seats. I do believe they are two unique issues. They overlap. They could be considered together, but don't necessarily need to be. I wanted to thank Travis Nevins for his comments. He is from the labor community, and I've spoken to many people in the labor community, as well as not all people in the labor community are in unions. They're both union and non-union, so I just want to point that out. And the idea of having a voice not just people that understand the need to consider labor, but an actual seat at the table and for them to have a voice that they've been advocating for decades. This is really a perennial. This is not new. So I appreciate that we're bringing this up again. And I would just note that given the day and age that we're in and given the divisions that have been happening within the parties, I think that right now in particular is an exceptionally important and potentially very healing time to consider this. So I wanted to note that. And I do also want to note that there is a resolution that will be on the agenda, the Housing and Economic Development Committee agenda this coming week on the 8th, that will consider or propose adding a labor seat to the IDA. So I just wanted to make sure that the public is aware of that. They can look at that agenda. That will be sent to all legislators later today so that everybody has ample time to review that. And of course, that will then be, you will have 4 weeks before the full legislature, 1 week before Housing and Economic Development, and then 4 weeks before the full legislature. So, to the next legislative meeting, December 17th, I think it is, if I recall correctly. So, that's a heads up to everyone. Thanks.
Thank you, Anna. Anyone else on any topic that's not the IDA? All right, I'll take a quick go at it. Tie it in partly with my chair's report as well. I just want to acknowledge and thank Cornell University for recognizing Tompkins County government with one of their Togo Awards, at the Togo Awards on the 21st, I believe. Jason, Frank, and I were there on behalf of the county to accept the award given to us because of all the work that we as county government have been doing to try to mitigate and stop the spread of the virus in our community, the coronavirus. The work we've done in building collaborations with other entities in the community, working together, building a really robust team of people, some who were reluctant at first to come to the table and join us, because often we live in this world where people want to operate in their own silos and do their own thing. But this was a time when we needed all hands on deck, working smoothly, working together, and Jason, Frank, the school district, Louvelle, Bosey is Cornell University, Ithaca College and their administration, Cayuga Health Systems, City of Ithaca, just about everyone being involved in doing what we need to do to try to keep our residents safe. Alas, as Shauna said, we did lose one resident previously, and now we've lost three residents because of COVID. I was reflecting on Dr. Fauci and the other scientists who have been warning us of the second wave and the potential third wave. And I realize that these are folks who, you know, eat, sleep, live this sort of work in the communities. And I kept wondering, how do they know? Well, this has been their life work, and so they know. And we all ought to be really listening to them and taking it seriously. I know how hard it has been for folks to not be with family and friends and gather. And I can't imagine what the fallout will be from the Thanksgiving gatherings that just happened, watching the airports and how crowded they were with people, some wearing masks, some not. You know, travel. traveling to go be with family and friends. I get it. I understand. But I also know that unless we are all just biting the bullet and hanging in there and doing the right thing and following the guidance of the folks who have dedicated their life to this work, we are not going to get past this, and we're going to be seeing larger numbers of people, more than the 250,000 people throughout the United States, but in our own small community. So I am appealing and begging to folks to please be mindful, to please be careful, to please do your part to protect my health, even if you don't want to protect yours. I will do my part to protect yours. We anticipate that it's probably going to get worse. We don't want it to, but it's almost inevitable. So to the folks in our community who have experienced loss, to the folks who are struggling because they have contracted this virus, I know I speak on behalf of this entire legislature when I say we're thinking about you and we're sending positive healing vibes to you and for those who have experienced loss, sending you positive energy for comfort. It is not easy. So I just wanted to take a moment just to say that, because I know our community is going to continue to struggle. Thank you for allowing me to say that. The other thing I want to mention real quickly, on a more upbeat note, is on Thursday, July 3rd, most of you know I wear another hat as the executive director at GIAC. The GIAC Board of Directors is hosting its annual meeting. It will be virtual, of course.
Not July.
Jesus, not July. Thank you. December 3rd, 2 days from now. Thank you, Mike. So you're all invited. I believe it is only being done through the Facebook Live platform. So please visit GIAC's website or Facebook page for the link to participate in our annual meeting. And I also want to give a big shout out and thank you to the community, to the volunteers, to everyone who stopped by GIAC the 20th, where we hosted our annual harvest dinner. Yes, we couldn't sit together and eat in fellowship, but we gave out over 700 prepared meals that evening to community residents who were incredibly grateful and thankful. People sent us notes of gratitude, made posts of gratitude. George was there doing his part. So people are in need, and we all need to do our little part. And, you know, that really warmed my heart to see people show up, get their meals, families, as touchless as we can make it, and move on. So thank you to everyone who helped make that possible. Martha.
Thanks, Leslie, for those really important words. You have to just keep saying them over and over again. I've been waiting, I'm sure other people also, to hear what the CDC Advisory Committee on vaccine distribution decided. They voted today, and I just found an article that says that the first doses of the COVID vaccine should be given to an estimated 21 million healthcare workers and 3 million residents and staff of nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. So that they recommended. And mentioning the long-term care facilities being prioritized because they account for nearly 40% of deaths in this country from COVID. So I hope people can rally around that prioritization and understand those the reasoning there, and everybody buckle down and keep doing what we're doing and doing it better, because it's coming, vaccine's coming, but we have to wait a little longer.
Thank you, Martha. Just got a hang in there. It's coming. All right, anyone else? Okay. Thank you.
Leslie, I just put the link to that New York Times article in the chat, just if people want to read it.
Okay. Thank you, Anna. We'll move on to reports by County Administrator, County Attorney, and Finance Director. County Attorney. Jonathan, do you have anything for us this evening?
No, I have no report.
All right. Question from Dan.
Yeah, Jonathan, I read recently that there was some development in one of the opioid lawsuits, and I'm wondering if you could remind us. I know there are two different lawsuits, and I'm not really clear which one we're in. If you're not prepared to talk about it right now, that's fine.
No, there are numerous. I mean, we're involved in one lawsuit in particular. The main thing is that it continues to be adjourned because of COVID, like the expected trial dates and everything keep moving back. What I think people keep hearing about, and some I talked about in the past, is that companies one by one are going bankrupt or filing for bankruptcy, which kind of moves them out of our lawsuit into separate proceedings. And our attorneys represent us in those proceedings. But, and this, I think, was not unanticipated to begin with, that you start out with a lot of defendants, and then as they declare bankruptcy, they go into bankruptcy court in separate bankruptcies, and thus you end up with a whole bunch of different litigations rather than the one lawsuit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan, and thank you, Dan, for reminding us about that. All right. Finance Director, do you have anything for us?
No, I have no report tonight, but we did have one more auction property sell or get redeemed that we didn't do the auction this past year. So I think we're down to just six left. So
all right.
Where we're going, perhaps we'll have none of those properties carry forward into next year's auction. So that's a big plus.
That is a big plus. Thank you, Rick. Henry.
Yes, Rick, I was wondering, and I could ask Jason this too, whether you know the final amount of the contingency amount that will be attributed this year?
Do. Let me pull it up here. We went quite a bit over what was already budgeted.
Right.
So that's where we ended about a month ago by telling you we were already way over budget. The amount right now of additional appropriations that will be coming before the legislature is $694,000 over. And then we need to plan about another $200,000 on top of that for ones Jason nor I have seen yet, and that would bring it up to 894. So I would say roughly $1 million. I need about $100,000 to take care of things that come up between February, March, and April while we're closing the books. We usually have $50,000 or $60,000 worth of budget transfers that I have to use what's left of the contingency. So I'm going to be bringing a resolution to the budget committee, the next budget committee, that will be asking roughly for around $1 million to fund the contingency to take care of all the additional ones that we have and a guess of the ones that we will probably have till we close the books. And I just want you to know that even though we're saying we have $1 million more in contingency funding, you all have to know that to the extent we don't spend all that, it just all reverts back into the general fund at the end of the year. So if we don't use all of that appropriation, it will simply revert back to the general fund. Jason, do you have any comments on that?
No, other than just to remind folks that I think about 470,000 of it, 300 was for testing and 170 of it was for the homeless program that we put forward. Those were abnormal. So that's about $500,000. We're still probably, you know, around 600,000 over what we would have budgeted. And probably a good chunk of that has to do with, another third of that has to do with some disability payments. And probably a good portion of it also has to do with retirements and payouts. So, the only positive thing about that is it's not reoccurring, or these wouldn't be reoccurring expenses. And that's my point, is that these are not things that we would expect in this order of magnitude on the annual basis.
Yeah, just since Jason and I put the word out to departments that any terminal pay or replacement pay had to come into us within the next 2 weeks. That went out about 2 weeks ago. We got about 9 more as a result of that push to the departments to get them in the end of the year so that we can deal with these numbers effectively.
All right.
Thank you.
Better.
I'm sorry, Henry, you said you had something else?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
I said I like no report better.
Well, it started that way.
Deborah?
Yes, thank you. So does that mean that our operating budget for the year was a deficit, rather, was only $1 million?
No. What that means is you need another $1 million of you're going to have another $1 million of unanticipated expense as a result of the items that we're going to bring in front of you. So you're going to be taking $1 million of fund downs to pay for that expense. The operating deficit would be on the broader scope of the whole budget. These were just specific items that we traditionally go to contingency to pay out.
But don't we pull the operating deficits out of general fund anyway? So
not the revenues. Like a lot of the operating deficit is all the revenue shortfalls, the state shortfalls, the sales tax shortfalls, the room tax shortfall. Those just close directly into fund balance, and revenues don't affect the contingency here at all. This is just for unintended or unknown overages that the departments have to submit for one at a time. That's why it's called the contingency fund, things we didn't know of at the time of the budgeting process. So this just reflects those adjustments that hit expenditure accounts that went above, doesn't address the deficit as a result of revenues.
So we still don't know how much of a hit the general fund's going to take.
We're working on it right now. Kevin and I, Wednesday was the deadline for submissions to us, so this week we'll be spending time trying to identify what the estimated shortfall will be.
Thank you.
What we'll do also, Deborah, is when we have that number, we'll present it as what the operating shortfall will be, but then we'll also talk about the total fund balance used for the year, which will incorporate this additional million.
All right. Martha?
Thanks. Do you think, Jason, you'll have that number by the next budget meeting or not till after the first of the year?
When's the next budget meeting? The 14th?
The 14th.
We can try to. I mean, we should have enough time to try to get it together. The next budget meeting is when? The 15th?
Right. Yeah.
So we'll have it together before, hopefully, unless we run the major issue, which I don't know what we'll have, but we'll try to get it done at the latest by the 15th so we can talk about it.
Okay, even if it's a ballpark. I know you've told us many times, but it doesn't stick for some reason. The 300 some thousand for the testing, is that net after we get reimbursement?
It is. It's after reimbursement. So you'll see one of the slides that we have today is the summary. And we'll also talk about, we think we're probably coming up on the end of that funding, probably the beginning of January, if we're anticipating an increased testing amount like we've been seeing. So, we're going to start to put together a resolution for your consideration. I think at the next HHS meeting, I'm looking at it now, whenever the next HHS meeting is December 21st. So we may also try to bring that to Budget Capital and Personnel on the 14th, so that your first meeting in January you can consider action on it.
Okay, one more. Do we think that we have more terminal pay expenses than usual because of the early retirement program?
Most definitely.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Yes. Unfortunately, Jason, you sound like you're talking through a sock or something. It's, your voice is really not clear.
I took the sock out of my mouth before I. Here, how about this one?
That's better.
All right, I have the wrong mic on. Sorry.
Oh, great. That's what.
Hey, much better. Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Jason.
Welcome.
Jason, it's up to you now.
All right. Thank you very much, Leslyn. We have our 16th presentation here on COVID-19. I'll give you a little bit of a spoiler. It's not as controversial as dogs on the common, on the commons, but we're going to do – sorry, George. I had to throw that in there. We're going to – I say it's our 16th because it's the 16th time we've given this presentation, which we've done – every ledge meeting since early April, actually late March. A lot has happened. To second what Leslyn said is that it's probably going to get a little worse before it gets better, but I think we're hopeful that there's definitely light at the end of the tunnel that we're seeing. And it is unfortunate that we recently had some new deaths as a result of COVID. So as you can see, we unfortunately surpassed the 1,000 mark, I think just before Thanksgiving or around that time frame, in terms of total positive cases that we've had in the county. Now we're just at a little over 1,100 and about 315 additional cases since our last ledge meeting. And unfortunately, now we're up to 4 deaths. Since we last met, the continuation of certain executive orders, particularly the ones about remote meetings, has continued to the end of December. There's been the continuation on the moratorium of no residential evictions till January 1st. DOH issued some holiday guidance, and the governor, as of the other day, yesterday, the day before, talked about kind of a new phase, a winter phase, about some elements that the state is looking to take as we kind of go into this post-holiday winter surge of with an expected increase in cases. On our partner front, again, appreciated the acknowledgement from Cornell as a partner in this process. And I do feel that after COVID is behind us, the relationships that we've built with a lot of our partners are going to carry on much longer and last as we go into the future and will help us as a community as we move forward. So if there's any bright side of this, it's the stronger relationships we've had as a result. We worked with Cayuga Health Systems to open up the downtown sampling site, which opened last Friday and is functioning. It seems to be going well so far. A series of schools went remote following Thanksgiving, and we'll continue to work closely with them as we see what the impacts may be from a post-Thanksgiving travel and family gatherings to see if that's going to push more school districts to go remote or not. But I know they're all striving to try to stay as in-person as they can. We did issue our own out-of-state travel guidance and holiday safety guidelines, put together some good public information on it, also educate our own workforce about it as well. Had a series of public exposures that we put together some public notices on. And we did notify the neighbors on North Tioga Street in that region, that area, about the testing site that would be opening, so they were aware of it, and also gave them a point of contact with Cayuga Health Systems should they have any questions, so that they're informed of what's going on. Unfortunately, as we already talked about, we've had some new deaths as a result of COVID. Here's some graphics, and Frank, I'm going to turn it over to you to talk a little bit about these graphs and charts, unless you want me to do it.
Thanks, Jason. I think what you see here is a charting of how COVID has progressed since back in last April here in the community, and I think a picture tells a thousand words. You can see where we are right now. Our average 7-day average is close to it's the mid-20s, pushing up towards 30. and we have the most active cases that we've had. So we're, I think it's been said multiple times already, but we are in the midst of what is our biggest spike in cases. It is what you would imagine. We have folks that are traveling. We have small gatherings where it's being transmitted. We have households where we have a single case that ultimately results in the entire household being positive. So it's the things we've been talking about all along, trying to limit our points of exposure, mask wearing, social distancing, density, and the such. The team of the health department and all of the county folks that have been working on this are they're working really hard, and I couldn't be more proud of what they've been able to do through all of this. These are long days with a lot of work to do the high quality case investigation and contact tracing that we're able to do. But I think these two graphs kind of paint the picture for where we are right now.
This is a slide that we've had, I think, every time we've given the presentation, talking about hours worked, overtime hours, total cost of regular pay. As you can see, we're well over $1.5 million of regular pay. There's two types of leave here that showed. One is what I would call the Extended Family Medical Leave Act, and then also federal pay for folks that are in quarantine, or federal leave for quarantine or for positive tests. And you can see hours as a result of that as well, and then our related expenses are over $1 million. You know, some of this will be reimbursed, some of it won't be, and we're working through reimbursement as every day. I can tell you that it seems to be the federal government is changing what's to be reimbursed on a regular basis, so there isn't any consistency with it, but we're kind of trying to stay on top of it as much as we can and submitting reimbursement regularly for the community testing site, but also now our first submission, I think, for the first half of the pandemic, and then we'll continue to track and submit more as we go through this. But you know, it's an ongoing process to stay on top of FEMA and ensure that we're going to be maximizing our reimbursement to the best we can. We have not yet to date, just so you know, received any reimbursement. We have submitted quite a bit of reimbursement for community testing. And I think the last time I had a conversation pre-Thanksgiving with NYSAC and other county administrators, we were the furthest down the path of review for that community testing, because we shared our approach and process, but we have not had anything reimbursed yet. Check is in the mail, apparently.
Jason, I wrote to NACO and haven't heard back yet about whether other counties are getting reimbursement. Haven't heard back. On this slide, I've been meaning to ask. So, yep. FFRP full pay. Is that one employee goes to work, gets a test? So, can you explain this? This
sure.
is where somebody is tested.
This is where folks would be may have to quarantine. They may have to quarantine as a result, or they may be ill with COVID. And this is the full pay they get for having to stay in quarantine, meaning they can't, obviously, if they can't work and they have to be in quarantine, this is the pay that covers them under the federal Families First Coronavirus Response Act.
So that doesn't mean 20 employees have been positive. What is?
No, that could mean folks that could be positive. It could mean folks that have to quarantine as a result, and therefore they qualify for this federal leave. It's the same leave for both instances.
Jason, if I may, it could also mean an employee who is just going to get a test. It's when you use that leave for 2 hours to get your test.
Right. Okay. So there's another component to it. So because we'll allow employees to get a test during work hours if they need to.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Frank, I'm turn this over to you.
So, Martha, you talked about the vaccine information, and we knew that ACIP was meeting today to review those. their work today that they voted on as a recommendation that now has to be reviewed and ultimately implemented by federal authorities. So it's step one in that process. Good news. I think what's the most promising is the amount of vaccine that they believe is available. So we're hopeful that that all that plays out, and here in December we're able to handle all of the phase 1A priority population. So how are we going to do that? We had to submit a COVID-19 vaccine distribution plan to DOH. We did that a few weeks ago. Much of it just refers back to our previously existing public health emergency preparedness plan and our medical countermeasures. So medical countermeasures is just how we describe when we have to provide medicine of some sort, either a vaccine, antibiotics, or others to the population. So the good news is we have plans for being able to administer vaccines to the population. We've been meeting with Cuyahoga Health Systems as well as the long-term care facilities, hospital workers and long-term care workers and residents have long been in that first priority group. So we've been planning to be able to administer the vaccine once we get it to those populations. So that work is coming along. We've also reviewed our memorandums of understanding with potential pod points of dispensing around the county. We've had agreements for many years with several locations. There are other parts of the county that we are still looking at to make sure that we have locations that are spread throughout, but understand this is going to come in phases. So as we do the priority populations, those are going to be more targeted and likely in their facility. When we get to broader vaccine availability for the population, we're going to try to make it as available as quickly to as many people as possible, and then we will address making sure that we can get it out to get it out into other parts of the county that might have might not be as close to the center. We still don't know the timeline. It is sounding like sometime in December we might actually have vaccine in hand to be able to begin administering it, but we won't really know that for certain until it starts moving. And we've created a section on the website about vaccination, so it's set and ready to go for us to pull up information as it becomes available.
This is just a description of our microcluster definitions that the state's put out in terms of, there's been some questions about how the state determines its different zones in terms of its rolling average of positivity rate. We also put ours on there, which is fairly below the yellow zone. So as of right now, we have we're far off of risk of coming into a yellow zone, but it's still a possibility, particularly with some of the other criteria. Although I think we should add that the state is not exactly 100% transparent as to how it makes the determination of a municipality in terms of its data. So while we've tried to track it the best we can and stay ahead of it, there isn't necessarily clarity as to what numbers the state uses to determine in positivity rates. But nonetheless, we constantly are in conversation with each other about where we stand. Frank or Amy, you want to take this slide? Or?
Sure. So our Jason referenced in the beginning of the presentation about the downtown location. It is open and operational now, Monday to Friday, 8 to 4. It is a saliva collection site. So want to be clear, it's not a cheek swab or something like that. It's actually, you have to spit saliva into a tube, 3 milliliters of it, which sounds like a little bit until you have to spit 3 milliliters of saliva. So it does take a little bit of time to collect it. It's important that if you do use that site, you can't eat or drink or use tobacco for 30 minutes before the sample when you get there. It was designed for individuals living downtown and others that might have transportation issues. So we're still encouraging folks that have transportation to use the mass sampling site at the mall, because it is the largest, and you can see the most people, and we'd like to reserve downtown for those that might not be able to receive sampling at the mall. Of course, anyone is welcome. We just ask people to be judicious with the limited resources that we have. And it's really important that appointments are required for both sites. It's the linchpin to keeping it moving, to keeping wait times down, and making sure that we have enough appointments available for everyone that needs them. So it's really important that folks use the appointments for both facilities. And we wanted to talk a bit about contact tracing capacity. There's been a lot of questions. I want to start with a bit of an overview of what case investigations.
Frank, I'm sorry. Could we just go back for a second? I've had several questions from neighbors where the new testing facility is going in.
Sure.
And just to be clear, there will be off-street parking, and the appointments are set up so that you won't have lines of people there, correct?
Correct. Yes, there is off-street parking, and they are appointments for that very reason. We don't want to have large lines of people or people congregating.
Sorry to.
No, good question. Thanks, Rich.
May I ask a question about testing, as long as we're interrupting you? I'm sorry, Frank.
No worries.
But my husband was exposed at BJ's. And okay. So he immediately called to make an appointment for testing. And he couldn't get in until like 10 or 11 days after the exposure.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, is it safe to assume that if he had said that he was symptomatic, he would have been tested sooner?
Yeah, so there's a couple of answers to that question. But let's answer the second part first. If somebody is connected to a case or they're in quarantine and become symptomatic, we are in constant communication with the hospital about those individuals. And if we prioritize them for testing, they would get fit in for testing. You picked probably the worst time in our testing cycle. Your husband went in seeking sampling. There was a large influx that you'll see at the end of the slideshow about how many folks are being tested. At the same time as we were trying to expand, or CHS was trying to expand testing availability. So they have since then added Saturday and Sunday all day availability, as well as opened the downtown testing site, which has brought those wait times to get an appointment way down to where it's almost next day in almost every instance now. So we really got caught in a situation where they were looking to expand testing, and then we had the influx of folks seeking testing, and very rapidly, within a week's time, they had expanded two additional days at the mall and open downtown. So I think they're doing an amazing job of trying to be responsive to the need for testing.
Well, I didn't think it was necessarily all that bad a thing that he had to wait, because at least we didn't have to worry about a false negative.
That certainly helps, depending on when your exposure was. Waiting a few days is definitely recommended.
Thank you.
Frank, one other question about this testing. I saw a news article that said it was unclear about the payment options. I think it was the Ithaca Voice. It said if you're downtown, and I just want to make sure that any Tompkins County resident can get a free test at this site as well as at the mall.
Yes, it's being handled the exact same way at both locations.
Okay, thanks very much.
And Frank, can I ask one more question? Is the cost to us the same? Does it matter what test?
No, the cost to us is the same.
Okay.
So getting back to contact tracing, so let's talk a little bit about what we have in place. We have had 47 county staff that have completed the Johns Hopkins tracing training. In addition to excuse me, our 21 health department nurses and 11 other health department staff. So, excuse me, we have a pretty significant cadre of people that have been trained, and we've been marshaling those resources as numbers have increased. In the last couple of weeks, we've had a handful of folks that have done an amazing job of getting a scheduling system implemented in order to scale up. It's very difficult to have people working for 2 or 3 hours here or there and for the nurses to be able to effectively hand out tasks. So we've really gotten to a point now where folks are committed to full days for a week or two at a time, and we have 9 to 10 folks assigned each day to us. So that has been a big help. We continue to work with Cornell to try to set up a relationship to be able to access some of their master's in public health students. And they are, as they have been, doing the check-in calls and doing some contact tracing for us on the Cornell students. So if we can talk just a little bit about what all these folks are doing, just for clarity, it's probably been a while since we've run through it. So when we find out about a positive case, we get that through multiple ways, either directly from Cuyahoga Health System, if it's their testing, or through ECLARES, which is the state communicable disease reporting system. The nurses go in each morning and check on what we have at that moment, and they assign out those cases to our nursing staff. The reason that we use nursing staff is because we're calling a sick individual or someone that has just tested positive for an infectious disease. And so as you can imagine, it's a difficult call to get. And oftentimes there are a lot of health-related questions that that individual has. And so I feel that it's very important that we have a medical professional that's on the other end of the line to help support them through what is a difficult phone call to get. So the nurses make those calls. They first make sure that the individual is okay and that their healthcare needs are met. Then they talk to them about isolation and making sure that they're able to isolate where they are for the 10 days. And then they begin to talk to that individual about the contacts. So the nurses will go through with that individual everywhere that they were been for the 2 days prior to the onset of symptoms or a positive test for an asymptomatic individual, and everyone that they might have had close contact with, meaning within 6 feet for more than 10 minutes, and that can be a cumulative 10 minutes time. And in some instances, we make some other determinations about contacts that might be a little gray on that, and those are made on a case-by-case basis. So once all of those contacts are identified, they get entered into our system, and the nurses or some of the contact tracers will begin to contact those individuals. In the beginning, the nurses were doing all of that. Now, much of that is being farmed out to the contact tracers that are assigned to the department, the helpers that we were talking about earlier. And they're making those contact calls to let the individual know you're a close contact of a known case. You're going to be in quarantine for 14 days from whatever that contact was. And they work with them to make sure that they don't have any needs. Are they healthy? Do they have symptoms? And make sure that their quarantine can be successful. Then from there, once somebody's in isolation and or quarantine, they're contacted every day throughout their isolation and quarantine. If they're in isolation, it's because they're a case and they get a phone call. Because these are sick individuals, we want to make sure that they're actually getting a phone call and somebody's talking to them about how they're doing. For the mandatory quarantined individuals, the vast majority of them are being contacted daily via text message. So they get a text message that says, how are you feeling? Do you have symptoms? Are you able to continue to quarantine effectively? If they answer yes, they go and they get a text message the next day. If they answer no, meaning they have symptoms or there's something going on, then that comes back to us and we reach out to find out what their needs are. So those calls are also being done by the helpers. So we've really tried to bring in resources so that the nurses are focusing on the case investigation, which is the point where they're calling a sick individual or someone that's recently tested positive for an infectious disease. So that's the system and kind of how we have it stood up at this point and how we're using the county staff to support the work of the nurses.
Thank you.
Anna?
Just a quick question. I know this has come up among a few of us, but if someone had a set amount of training for the protocol you just described, do you think it would be possible and safe to have that job done by someone who isn't a nurse? I know that is currently dictated by the State Department of Health, but let's just say there was a temporary emergency consideration to expand that to allow us to have more flexibility and a greater pool of people that we could pull from to do that work, given the surge that we're seeing throughout the state and country. I'm curious what your take on that would be.
Sure. So there is no requirement that it be a nurse that does the case investigation calls. We have made that decision locally because we believe it's best practice and that it puts us in a position to provide a high quality of care to an individual that is either sick or has just tested positive for an infectious disease. And in most instances, they're going to have healthcare questions associated with their diagnosis. And if it was not a healthcare provider, there likely would be questions that would have to get referred back to a healthcare provider to answer anyway, because a non-licensed professional would not be in a position to answer those questions. So I'm not sure that it would actually save a whole lot for us. And I'm pretty sure that it would decrease the quality of that first contact with someone that has just been diagnosed. Our nurses are well-trained and well-experienced. This is what they do, and they know how to do it and do it well. And we feel like using their expertise is the most appropriate and effective way to move somebody from a diagnosis into isolation successfully.
Is there a part of the process that is done that isn't done by nurses, like follow-up?
Yes, pretty much everything except for that first call that is the case investigation is being done at some time by someone that is not a nurse. Our nurses are still doing some contact tracing on slower days, but when we're super busy, the contact tracing today being an example was all shifted off to the helpers that have been assigned to the department, none of which are nurses.
Thank you.
I had questions about the contact tracers. Would you like those questions now?
Sure.
Okay. So I've talked about this before. I understand that our staff people are working a ridiculous number of days in a row, 7, 8, 9, 11, 18 days in a row, or 18 days out of 19 days, 27 days out of 28 days, things that are not sustainable. And so a lot of my questions have to do with what are we doing to find some help for these people, some new nurses. So I'll just stop right there if you want to comment at this point. I probably have some follow-up questions.
Sure. The scheduling as it's designed for the nurses is they work their normal week, and then once out of every 4 weekends, they're assigned to work on a weekend. There have been times where we've been super busy and we've called in people that were not assigned to that weekend. In those instances, the person that's called makes the decision on whether they are available or not. And there's been many instances where we've called folks and they just weren't available to come in. And so we dealt with it with the folks that we have on. So we're designed that folks shouldn't really go more than 12 days in a row. And even that 12 days in a row, if somebody's assigned to a weekend, we will work with them to try to find days during the week for them to be off so they don't have that full 12 days. And now, having said all of that, the nurses know what it means if you're short on nurses. And so many of them volunteer to work their normal 5-day week and the weekend that they're on, which would create 12 days, and then potentially work if called on a weekend that they're not assigned if we have caseloads that require some more help. So, yes, there are times where folks are working many, many days, but in those instances, there is an opportunity for them to opt out if they choose to do it. They're really – the thing that we're asking of them is to work one weekend out of every four for the nurses that are doing the case investigations. Our nurse managers, we only have three of them, so they're working one out of every 3 weekends.
Could you send us the schedule? Could you send the legislators the schedule of the nurses for the past four, let's say 4 to 6 weeks, so that we can see?
HR, we have to pull that, but we could, I'm sure, find something. I don't want to speak for them. I don't have their schedules. They work what they work under the schedule that's designed for them. I don't know if anyone is outside of their timesheet looking at when they're coming in on times where they weren't scheduled. So we would have to, I'd have to look that up, Dan, and I have to talk to HR.
Okay, thank you. And so you've laid out a, you know, we both laid out the example of how everybody's working a lot more than the rest of us are probably. So what's being done to find new nurses? Is there anybody that is, whose job it is to be right now looking for more nurses to hire?
Yeah, so we have a couple of things going on. I have one vacant community health nurse, a permanent full-time position. I will have a second one vacant on December 18th due to a retirement. We have been actively recruiting for that position for well over 30 days, and we've received one application. We just reposted it. We're waiting for HR to review the application that we have to see if it's appropriate for interviewing. And then we will interview that candidate, and we will continue to recruit for the other position. I would have to defer to human resources as far as the extent of what's going on with advertising and the such. But there is obviously, anytime we have a vacancy, we're actively trying to fill those positions. Both of those vacancies are due to internal promotions that just occurred. Right. So the vacancies are left behind by two individuals that are now senior community health nurses.
I can imagine that it would be very hard to hire a full-time nurse right now. They're in high demand. We don't have a full-time permanent nurse. What about temporary per diem nurses? We need nurses like now. We need them for the next 3 or 4 months probably. What is being done? What can be done to solve that problem?
So we have two traveling nurses that have just begun with us in the last 2 months, one in the last week, the other one about a month ago. We are looking for a third traveling nurse. We're contracted with a national nursing supplier and have not been able to yet identify a nurse from them for us to contract with. Human Resources entered into an agreement. Well, I guess technically the health department did, but Human Resources looked for and found us an agency that was willing to work with us. They have been trying. We've increased the rate that we were willing to offer in order to try to attract additional candidates through that, and we have not been able to fill that third traveling nurse position yet. It is not permissible, as I understand it, for me to contract with an individual because of tax law, and I would defer to Rick to explain that. I just do what I'm told on that one. So we have to go through an agency to bring people on, and that's what we've tried to do. I know HR talked to multiple agencies about trying to find us nurses, and this was the one that felt like they would be able to. And we've been working with them. Like I said, we found two and are still looking for a third one. Nurses are good to come by.
I don't need the answer right now, but I really would like a follow-up to why can't we hire a nurse, let's call it, off the street. Tax law doesn't seem like that would be, I don't know. I would love a follow-up on that answer, please. And just also a reminder that we are in an official declared state of emergency. And a lot of rules can get suspended in a state of emergency. So I really want to see all possible ways explored that we can get some additional qualified people into the health department to be doing this task, which is not only for the sake of our own employees, but because this is the front line of our fight against coronavirus. And I really, really, really believe that there is a way to do this, and I want help in finding that way. Thank you.
Sure, and if you're aware of any nurses out there that are interested, we'd be happy to talk with them and try to figure out how we could bring them on board.
All right. Or Amy, do we want to talk about the state's winter approach?
Sure. So yesterday, I believe the governor announced a little bit about this winter approach, and the approach is outlined here. I will say that there's still not a lot of details on this approach. So strategy one looks at that hospital capacity. They are looking at focusing the numbers on hospitalizations and hospital capacity, looking at different rates along this. We do not have those numbers yet. Something should be coming out by the end of this week or early next week is what we've heard. Strategy two really looks at testing, making sure testing is available. You can see here they are looking at how to increase testing in a way that allows for, you know, different segments of the population to be fully tested. Three is keeping the schools open, really focused on keeping K through 8 open whenever it's safe. They are looking at those zones that we talked about earlier and the testing requirements in those zones. I will say we have positive, not only are we not in those zones at this point, we also have testing capacity here, which is a positive to all of this. We would have to up that capacity if we ever went into a zone, but that's something that we have started to plan for and we'll work with. The next one is really looking at a public education campaign around these small gatherings, as we're seeing that's where a lot of the spread is coming from, and we talked a little bit about that, and that's what we're seeing in our numbers. And then strategy five really is this vaccination program. And so, again, more details will be coming, but these are the five strategies rolled out yesterday. And then the last slide is our county-sponsored testing. These are the testing at the CHS sampling sites within our county, so both the mall site and the downtown site. I will say that in this range, the downtown site was only open, I think, one, if not 2 days, so it's not pushing the numbers. But at the same time, what you will find is, again, just as a reminder how this chart works, is all the people tested in those sites, and then it goes into everyone that's from Tompkins County, those without symptoms or exposure, and then those without sponsoring organizations. So they don't have insurance, or insurance won't cover why they're being tested. And then you get into the weekly total costs. You will see our total costs have been rising a little bit. We have additional people going to get tested. So the total numbers tested are going up, and then the Tompkins County numbers are going up, as well as those that are going who may not have symptoms. In this time period, we do have public exposures. Deborah talked about the BJ's exposures, as well as others that may be driving people to get tested. So this is the overall. As I look at this now and the projections now, as far as where we are with funding, we will be probably bringing something to you at Budget, Capital, and Personnel, if not this month, early next month, because, again, we're seeing an increase in this percentage. So if we were to project it out, I think our funding would go through the end of December, early January. And we have not received any FEMA reimbursement, as Jason said. We are hopeful that we will receive this FEMA reimbursement. We have put it into the system, and we've been invoiced for everything that's here, and most of this has gone into the FEMA system. I will say there's a couple weeks that it's a little complicated. It's not as easy as once you receive the invoice, putting it to FEMA. You have to wait until the check is cashed, and they can have a picture of that check. So it takes a little longer, but it is getting inputted.
We'll try to bring that forward, at least to get it in the queue this month. So if you have to take action early January, it'll be ready to roll. Yeah. But that's the end of the presentation. If there are other questions or other slides you want me to go back to before I take it off?
Mike Lane has a question.
Frank, your slide that showed the curves with the number of cases, I was just wondering, are we tracking very similarly to what happened in the flu epidemic of 1918. Is anyone looking at that? I know that in Tompkins County, the first deaths occurred in October after a low incidence during the summer, and they thought it slowed down from the spring. Do we know if it's similar? You may not have the answer to that, but it made me think of that, seeing the increase.
Yeah, I don't know exactly, but it is a fairly common epi curve that we're seeing right now with these types of diseases. We generally see a lull in the summer months when it gets warmer and people are outside more, and then as we come into winter, we start to cycle back into it. It also probably matches pretty closely with the common flu cycle. That normally peaks in February or so. So let's hope we don't continue to follow that path.
Thank you.
Henry?
Yes. Thanks, Frank. I have a number of questions. The first one is, could you explain the contract tracing at Oak Hill Manor? You said that the state does it. Are you informed anything, or how does that work?
Yeah, so what happens is we are alerted to the positive results, because every positive result is required to be reported to the local health department. But once we become aware that it's related to a nursing home, we are to transfer to that case to the state, and we close it out in our system and they take over. So the way that it works is the New York State Department of Health is responsible for contact tracing and all of the requirements within a nursing home when there are COVID cases, and we handle any contacts that are outside. So say there's an employee or a family member visited, and then they become a contact. We would take care of the contact tracing outside of the facility. But as far as inside, it's a wholly New York State Department of Health jurisdiction.
Okay. Anna brought up the issue of volunteers, and I also sent you an email today about volunteers. Would, in fact, additional volunteers help with the issues that Dan raised?
So the challenge that we're faced with, and we went through this with our own internal staff initially, is it's very challenging to use people for a couple hours at a time. Because what it ends up creating is we don't know how much they'll accomplish in that time, because when you're making calls, you don't know who's going to answer, you don't know how many questions they're going to have, and then inevitably there's work that was assigned that didn't get completed, and that has to be handed off. And as that happens multiple times, you introduce error into the process. So, and really it creates more pressure on the nurses, because they're having to track to make sure that work is actually getting done. Whereas when we have people for a full day and a full week of work, it makes it easier, because we can assign a full day's worth of work knowing that they're going to get the bulk of it done, and they can report to us throughout the day how they're going. We've also instituted team leads now for the volunteers, but the other county departments that are helping us. So the nurses can hand off at the beginning of the day the work that needs to be done to the team lead, and then that person is distributing it out and making sure that if somebody's not able to complete something, it's getting shifted to somebody else. So that's a long answer to, it's very challenging to manage short intervals of volunteer time, because you end up training and teaching and then they're gone, and then they're coming back, and you don't know how much work they're going to get done. And all of that requires management that, quite frankly, has proven to be more work than the initial help that was being provided.
Also, I know that there's another vaccine from the UK which does not need to be frozen as much.
I can't hear you.
Okay, that there's other vaccines that are out there that the UK has that do not need to be frozen as much. Do you know what kind of vaccines we'll be getting?
So they'll all be approved right before they're administered. I believe the Pfizer one is the first one in the hopper, and Moderna is next. Obviously, they all have to have emergency use authorization before they'll begin to be administered. The important thing to remember is that they're going to be multi-dose vaccines, meaning you're going to need a second dose a few weeks after the first. and you have to get the same vaccine. So if your first one is Pfizer, your second one has to be Pfizer. If your first one's Moderna, the second one. So there's going to be some management of that as well. But we won't know really what we're getting until the approvals are in place and the federal distribution system starts to unfold to tell us which one we'll be getting.
Okay, so you don't have a choice in which one you're getting?
No, there won't be a choice. There won't be a choice by us locally on what we're given, and there won't be a choice on an individual level about which one you're getting either.
Okay, and I have a question for Jason. Since Martha sent around an email today talking about the possible stimulus funding, the COVID funding, do you guys have a plan in terms of if we do receive any money from the feds, how that money will be spent?
I think it won't necessarily determine. We won't be the ones my guess is we won't be the ones determining how it'll be used. It'll be dictated to us with whatever parameters are part of the legislation that's passed. It's likely, you know, I don't know that it would be unrestricted in that sense. And you have to keep in mind there would be anywhere from the restrictions to how it's distributed. Is it based on population? Is it based by demographics? You know, all of those things I think have yet to be figured out. So my guess is that we wouldn't have a whole lot of discretion, as to how it would be used. But, you know, as soon as we get word that this happens, you know, most likely what happens, we'll get some more context as to what's being proposed, and there'll be a parallel track of, you know, us working with NYSAC and NACO, understanding how it could be used or estimating how much we might get before it's actually voted on. So there'll be some level of preparation. And when we know that, obviously, we'll share that with the legislature. And if there is discretion, then we'll try to understand where would be the best use and why.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
I'm done.
Thanks, Henry. Martha, and then Anna, then I have a couple of follow-ups.
Thank you. To continue on the vaccination question, after the 1A is this first batch of priorities, after that, I guess my question is, do we have a local plan or do we just follow the state's list of priorities?
So there will actually come from the federal government, the list of priorities that come down through the state and then we administer. So we won't be making local decisions. The only time where we might do that is if we don't receive enough vaccine for a priority population group, right? So if you say, for example, to get everyone in 1A, we needed, and I'm just making this number up, 2,000 doses, and we only got 1,000, we may have some prioritization within that first priority group that we would have to do. But that would really be all the decision-making we would be making about who gets the vaccine.
And do you have a mechanism set up for that at this point?
We do. We've already been working with the hospital. They have their ethics board looking at putting in some prioritization. It's really going to be about, when it's with healthcare workers, who's most likely to be exposed to a COVID-19 case, right? So it really kind of narrows it down to hospital employees. And then even within the hospital, it would be the emergency department and the ICU and a COVID floor or a COVID wing. And that would include all hospital employees that work in that area. So maintenance, you know, the housekeeping, the food workers, everyone is kind of included in that group if they're, you know, working in those high-risk settings.
Okay. And because we talked about flu last time, flu shots, what's our uptake? Do you have a general sense? I don't know how much you track it usually, but you know, we do our own flu shot clinic. So do you have any idea how much we're penetrating with the flu shots this year?
Yeah, it's hard to know because flu vaccines are not required reporting. The state has the New York State Immunization Information System, NISIS. For anyone under 18, it is mandated that their vaccines be reported. For anyone over 18, you have to have their consent to even report it into the system. So we have a very low tracking of adult immunization rates because there isn't a mandate to report it. So it's hard to know what our uptake is.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Martha. Anna?
Hi, I think this is a very, very helpful conversation. So I just had one clarification. You mentioned it, but I just want to make sure I understand. The state at the nursing facilities and long-term care, they, like Oak Hill, manage all of the cases. But once there has been an identified case, they let us know, and that number is added. The positive case is added to our totals on the Tompkins County Health Department website, right?
Yes, the positive case actually starts with us because we're their mandated reporting agency. So we get notified of it. It is included in our numbers. And then once we become aware that it's a nursing home patient or employee, it gets transferred to the state.
And the numbers of the tests are also included in our number of tests.
Yes, as we're aware of them, yep.
And I have one other question. I have a constituent who is homebound, and she has people who come in as home health care aides. I brought it up before. I'm wondering if there's been any update on having a system in place where they can be tested if they're homebound. That's a huge concern of mine.
Yeah, it is still a challenge. And generally, so testing for us is to try to limit further exposure. So if they are homebound, their potential exposures to other people would be limited, right? So when we're prioritizing testing, it's about other exposures. The home health folks should be getting tested as part of their employment processes. And certainly they're available to get tested if they're a Tompkins County resident as well in our testing. So for an individual that is homebound, really, if they don't become symptomatic, getting tested doesn't really provide much information from an epidemiological perspective. If they become symptomatic, we would want them to seek healthcare advice on what they should do. In extreme circumstances, if we felt it was necessary, that we would work with Cayuga Health Systems to see if we could provide testing in home. But that's only in very, very rare circumstances that it would be important for us to know if that person was positive.
So just to understand what's defined as that rare scenario, so this person, a home healthcare aide, found out that they had been exposed. And there was no mechanism for, so this person who had been exposed was a home healthcare aide that went into her house. In a normal circumstance, that person would be tested. You know, we certainly try and create environments where people with disabilities have the same rights as everyone else. In that circumstance, that person would get tested. We would prioritize them getting tested, including providing a vehicle to take them to a testing facility. So I guess I'm concerned about, you know, just making sure that they have the same rights, you know, that we maintain that.
Sure.
So is that a scenario where?
Yeah, so you added more information to the scenario. If the person wanted to seek testing and was able to and willing to leave home, via transportation mechanism, we have a transportation mechanism in place to get folks taken to a test site. If you're talking about someone that's asymptomatic, I guess I didn't understand the exposure. Now you're saying that the home health aide is the one that was exposed
and came into this person's home, and this person is homebound and has an autoimmune disorder and cannot leave the house.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So the concern is that the aide brought it into the home and that individual may have been exposed. So we would work through those situations. It's part of the contact tracing. So when we talk to that individual, we would account for any and all of their needs. We don't necessarily recommend that everyone that is in quarantine needs to get tested. We do say if you want to, here's the time frames you should probably go, to allow for the incubation period. And if somebody was in a situation where they needed support to try to get tested, we would, of course, work with them.
So that is that rare case where the person's homebound, they have been potentially exposed. That's that potential rare case that to treat them the same, we might
figure out a way to get them tested at home.
Yeah, understanding we have a transportation mechanism in place. So if right. it's just a matter of transportation, homebound right. means they're in a bed and can't leave the bed. Right. Then we would probably be working with them and their healthcare providers to figure out what's the appropriate course of action. Right.
And just to be clear, in this scenario, if the healthcare worker is not a positive but is a contact of a positive, then the person that's homebound would be a contact of a contact, and we wouldn't recommend they get tested. So yeah. contacts of contacts are not recommended for testing.
Okay. In general, for anybody.
Okay. Yep. So I know this topic generates a lot of conversation, and people use this opportunity to get answers. So Annie, then Shauna, I'm still in queue.
Thank you for that answer, by the way.
Sure.
Thank you. So hopefully a quick question with a quick answer. So for I was going to ask about the procedure for the saliva test. So, and I'm not sure if you already covered this. So are people who are getting tested go there and do the saliva sample, or do they pick up a kit and go home and do the saliva sample? How does that work?
So they go in and they pick up a kit. Generally, I think we're asking folks to go out to their vehicle and, you know, collect the sample. If they walked up, there are some spaces within the building that are set up where they could safely collect the sample there in the building. I believe you can also take it home and bring it back if you want to. I would just encourage folks to try to do it all at the time that you go there, because the more time between when you pick that sample up and you collect it, there's just a whole lot of room for error and other problems to come along, or to just forget or not make it back. And so I would really encourage folks to collect their sample when they pick up their kit and give it right back, because you're going to get your result quickest at that point as well.
Okay, so they have to maybe go stand outside, or they might have someplace inside for them?
They would not have to stand outside. If they don't have a vehicle to go to, there are spaces inside the building set up for them to collect their sample.
Okay, because it sounded like this was primarily for walk-up. So
correct.
Okay, yep. And then just a follow-up with the folks that Anna was just talking about that might be homebound or having difficulty getting there. Could someone pick up a kit, you know, and give them have them do the saliva test and somebody bring it down for them if they did it very quickly?
I don't know the answer to that, Annie. I'll have to check into that and get back to you.
Okay. All right. That's all I had. Thank you very much, Frank.
Sure.
Thank you. Shauna.
I just had a quick question about employees that are positive. Are we actually doing the contact tracing, or would the county that the person lives in do the contact tracing?
The county that the person lives in does the case investigation.
Okay. Thank you.
Didn't hear the answer to that. So there are a couple of quick things. Henry mentioned the use of volunteers, and Frank, I wasn't clear in your answer. I can call you later. I'll need to repeat it. But if I understood from your slide and your explanation, contact tracers, it seems like there are adequate numbers of people to do that. You said they were 47 who were trained and an additional 11, an additional something else. Because the county, the message that Henry, that you sent out, that said this, I think it's Clinton County, they're using volunteers to contact tracers, not yeah. contact investigators. And what I'm hearing, and in line with Dan's questions, is that contact investigators, which are people with more of a medical background, is what we use here in this county, is the area where you're looking to hire more of. Not contact tracers, is that correct?
Correct. We've built up a pretty strong contact tracing group, and we're continuing to build it. We're not 100% there where the nurses are handing off all contact tracing. We're getting closer. But really where we are, as Dan was describing, our shortage is with the nurses that are doing the case investigation, so the first contact with a positive individual.
Okay. And then this is a follow-up that probably goes to Dan more than, you know what, I'll just ask Dan myself later on. It's not necessary for us right now. Anything else on this topic? I thank you all for all the information, by the way. It really does answer a lot of questions. All right. I see nothing else. As always, thank you, Frank, Amy, Dom, Jason, everyone who is not sitting around twiddling their thumbs, but working very, very hard to make sure we're all as safe as we can be. And every day it's changing, every moment there's something new that we have to respond to. So thank you very much for your time on it. Okay. Anything else from you, Jason?
I don't have anything else to update you on. No. Thank you very much.
Okay. Wonderful. We're going to move on. I know there's staff waiting, and so I want to get to the folks who are waiting. I see Barb. I know there's it's okay if you all indulge me so I can move stuff around a little bit so staff don't have to sit around. Did I miss any other staff who's waiting? It's just Barb, right? Okay. So, Mike, why don't we take up that resolution from your committee, from Facilities and Infrastructure?
Sure.
So that Barb can go to dinner.
We had a meeting on November 19th, which all of the legislators were invited to. I think we had 10 who were able to attend. And we heard the report from Barbara Ekstrom and from Jason Molino regarding the problems we have with the new contract that we're going to have to be letting. It's going to cost a lot more money to do recycling. And we had a thorough discussion of various options, and that result was this resolution, which I'm about to move. But I want to say to you that I think the understanding was that we were making a decision whether or not to continue our recycling program as best we can, despite the increased costs, unlike some of the counties surrounding us which are doing away with them. So I'm going to make that motion to establish a unit charge for 2021 solid waste annual fee. That's ID 9734. It's resolution M. I so move.
All right, that's moved by Mike, seconded by Deborah. And before anyone else speaks, I want to ask Barb if there's information you want to share.
We actually have a very quick presentation. I don't know if you want that or if it's as straightforward as just doing the vote.
I'm sorry.
She's offering a short presentation if we want it.
Oh, that would be fine. Since you already prepared it, go ahead.
Okay. We just need to put it up. So
I'm going to share the screen right now. Hi, everybody. I'm Jeremy.
Hi, Jeremy.
All right. You should be able to see the presentation now.
Mm-hmm. It's right there. Okay, great. You know, in the scheme of things, as I listen to the COVID discussion, while this is important, there's other things putting this in perspective. Basically, we've been ongoing, and Jonathan's on this call too, for about a year and a half, going through the legal process of getting proposals. There was a draft and then a final. I'll summarize the work. We'll be sending the single stream recycling to the Ontario County Recycling Facility. Commercial cardboard will still be baled with our 25-year-old baler, which is still okay for that piece. At our facility, garbage is going to be transported to the Ontario County landfill through a separate contract. We've got a residential drop-off area at the recycling center, which is the envy of most counties in the state. We also have a food scrap transfer area that sends material for composting, both commercial and our residential drop-offs. The proposal also includes construction and site improvements. This facility, while we've done a little work here and there, is also getting older. We did do a capital program budget, and that, and we meet, you know, we met that. Remember, this is the first time that it's a living wage requirement, whereas before we paid them and they did services instead. This is a 5-year contract, not 10, because there's a lot that can change. Next slide, please. So just in summary, for those of you that are new to this, back when we negotiated our contract, the assumptions that were made, well, we did receive two bids, and the contract was very favorable. When we compared it to everybody else in the state, it was quite a bit lower. And then things changed. The industry, as you know, changed because China, that was taking most of the product, started to refuse the high contamination that was caused really by the single stream recycling. So it increased costs for the companies to, you know, add the equipment needed to help that situation out. We are getting about 70% less in the form of revenues. The risks that and the costs from COVID-19 are real. To better protect and you know, take care of the employees, there was a lot of social distance. And as you know here, there's costs that go with the protection. And we only received one proposal. Waste Management opted out, even though we thought they were interested, because they only want to deal with garbage, which is not our area primarily of work. They just aren't interested in recycling because they don't know how they're going to do it to make enough money at new facilities. Next slide, please. Okay, so here's where we're at. Our operation costs are, we budgeted some increase in cost for the facility, but it is much higher. The main areas that are costing more money, the single stream recycling, loading the trucks, transporting, and the processing. We're on average with the rest of the state when it comes to that, slightly a little bit lower by a few dollars a ton. The big increase this time was the public drop-off area. We do many, many materials there. I think last count was 16, and they were losing money. And we knew they were losing a lot of money, but we didn't want to change the contract. So now they're still going to do the work, minus fluorescent tubes are going to wind up going in the household hazardous waste collection. And we're also going to, we've been talking about eliminating the non-required electronics, but I'm having second thoughts about it. And we'll find the money to pay for $12,000 to keep those in. The only other thing that's going away are the plastic bags. We haven't produced a bale in 2 years, and we get so much trash and dirty bags that we're going to leave it to the grocery stores that are required to just do their own bags and that kind of thing. Cardboard, like I said, we're still going to process that. It's a slightly higher cost. And, of course, I've mentioned the decrease in the revenues. Next slide, please. Okay, so the construction and equipment costs, this is a summary. What we're going to do, and we will make you more familiar with how we're going to go about this and the options for financing. We are not planning to borrow for this. We're going to pay for construction costs from the fund balance. Remember, we've got $2.1 million in there. So part of that is going to wind up going for the construction, and the other part is going to make up the difference for the operations, that additional money. We also have a capital and equipment reserve that totals about $600,000. So we've got the finances pretty well figured out. We will apply for a grant from the DEC for capital investment that we've always been successful at getting, and it will fund up to 50% of the cost, but it's going to take 3 to 5 years for that to come in based on what we're hearing. You know, there's all kinds of things in here. I only listed a few things, but we've got heating ventilation issues. We've got the overhead doors that need to be replaced. Tipping floors need to be upgraded. There's pavement all over the site, especially at the public drop-off, drainage issues, and others. The other thing we're doing is we're purchasing. We're going to get a compactor that can more efficiently transfer the single stream recyclables to Ontario County. That has saved us about $7 or $8 per ton on the operational cost. Next slide, please. All right. Now, financing. This is where, you know, I have to thank Jason for leading me along here. And what I wanted to just preface this by saying, what we did was we looked at what would happen. I do a 5-year budget every year because I've got to know what is in store for us with the contracts and the financing. So based on the increased costs for operation and the need to use the fund balance in part to pay for construction, the county administrator and I developed several financing options for a 5-year budget. So I'm not going to get into the details, but what we did was we looked at staying at the what was originally going to be 65 in the budget for the annual fee and then various increases along the way. Only options 4 through 6 will restore the fund balance to 18% of our budget within 5 years. Next slide. Okay, Jason, do you want me to continue or do you?
Sure, I mean, you're doing great, Barb.
Well, listen, jump in.
Sure.
if you feel compelled. Okay, so let me just hone in on option 4, which is what the committee voted in favor of. So you clearly understand. And I had to leave out a couple of the little details in here to fit these all on one page. That was Jason's request, so I did the best I could. So you can see, and remember, there's other charges for other, you know, sectors like the universities and the businesses. This is basically going from the what we budgeted of $65 to the $70 fee. Okay, which is an 18% increase. And the revenue that we're looking for is a little over $4 million on a $7.5 million budget. The rest of it is paid for through disposal fees. You can see, oh, I was wrong. That's right. We had to correct the fund balance. It's slightly higher than 2.1. We got correct information from REC after we did this. So, you know, that's a good fund balance, and our motto has been to save, 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 and try to keep the annual fee as low as possible over the years, and that's been a strategy. But what we're going to have to do, we go from the $70, and, of course, you know, we're still going to be a little short on balancing that budget, but we're going to go to $75 and then $5 each year thereafter. I did include getting the grant money in 2024, assuming we're going to get like 40% instead of the 50%. Mm-hmm. And then you can see that at the end of the period, we will have sufficient money for an 18% fund balance. Okay. So, and we're really not shabby. I mean, even in, you know, the climbing years, we're reasonable. I mean, we're certainly not going to be at our normal fund balance. Now, one thing to keep in mind with this is this does not include anything else in my budget that's going to change over time. Okay, that could be the leachate turns out to be much higher that we have to treat. We're going to have salary and fringes and, you know, et cetera, in our other contracts will go up. But it's reasonable. And like Dan Klein said at our last committee meeting, it is hard. Yes, it's good to do a five-year budget, but there's no guarantees. And we'll know a lot more as years go on. I did anticipate a slight revenue increase from 2023 with recyclables on, but very slight. So that's just walking you through the one option. And you can see option one is miserable. We can't do that or we're going to be in financial trouble.
Barb, if I could add one thing here. I think you've covered everything great. The one thing that we're not showing on this, and it's primarily just a space issue, but it was part of the larger presentation at F&I, is that you're still running operating deficits for, you know, a year to 3 years, depending on what option you pick. Option one, you're running operating deficits for all 5 years. Option four through six really puts you in the best position to, you know, come out of an operating deficit in years two and three to where you're finishing year five, assuming, you know, all variables we've considered stay intact at a, you know, growing a fund balance and having a balanced budget. And that was one of, I think, the key factors when we looked at as to where you want to recommend. Your options three through six really get you to that point, but option four seemed to be the option that the committee settled on, which I think both Barb and I would recommend as well, putting you in a good position, at least in the first few years, to balance that operating budget in the first few years and then continue to maintain a healthy fund balance for year six when you come into this and what other expenditures you may have in future years.
Remember why we have a fund balance so high. One is because of the old landfills that we're still monitoring and the danger of, you know, the wells in neighborhood wells, residential wells turning out to have problems. And the second, of course, is unknowns in the recycling market. And I'm imagining that this is going to be an annual conversation for sure. Next slide, please. Okay. Just to give you some perspective, and we talked about this briefly, and Mike Lane actually put it well. Deborah Dawson mentions something along these lines. What we're doing in this county is that we are continuing to recycle. We are not doing what lots of places are doing where they're eliminating or cutting services. We offer a lot more than any other county or planning unit in the state. We've studied this quite a bit, and we're spending a lot less money. So to give you a sense of this, $58 pays for the recycling facility, the food scrap drop-offs, the Rebusiness Partners program, our staffing, and all the other programs. Recycling collection is a mere $28 a year per household. And I know that the neighboring counties and even the other ones that our staff benchmarked, on average, it's $175 for those two components. And they're not even doing the public drop-off area or food scraps and, you know, so many of the other materials that we're doing. So just to put it in perspective, I believe that even with these increases, we're getting, we have a situation that isn't ideal, but we can move forward economically with recycling in our community. That's it.
Okay.
Leslie, I want to make the point that the resolution that's been offered tonight sets the fee for 2021. We have these five-year projections, but we are not committing to what's shown as over 5 years. It may very well work out to be that as we go along in the future years. But right now, we are setting the solid waste fee for 2021.
Thank you. Jeremy, can you stop sharing the screen for me so I can see who else has hands up? Thank you, and
Thanks, Barb, and thanks, Jeremy. Thanks, Jason. I think it's important for a public or watching or viewing public to know why we're raising the fee some more.
Leslie, I can also add one thing. There's going to be public education about this. There's a press release that Dominic has drafted with needing some quotes, and that'll go out, and then we'll be doing our social media and all of the other things along with any other fees that we're going to be sharing information, because the conversation about what the fee pays for, and we do have a RAC card that explains, and we'll be handing that out readily, as to what exactly the fee pays for and what the categories of payments are, because it is an educational process, and it is not the most straightforward thing in the world.
Thank you, Barbara. You read my mind. All right, a couple of questions here. Mike Sigler and then Henry Granison.
Hi, actually, Barb, I have like three questions. Last time we talked, but about 18 months ago, maybe 2 years, there was a belief that some more processing centers were going to be coming online both here and in Canada. Is that happening? Is that not happening?
Yeah, that's a good memory, Mike. There's one or two that are now operating in the Midwest and in Canada. There's two. And there's about nine more that within 3 years will be operating. And there's reasons why I believe, and others in the field do, and there's a lot written about it, that the recycling markets with supply and demand will improve.
Okay, well, that actually answers my second question, too. My other is not really on recycling. It's just on Seneca Meadows. I mean, that seems like it's going to close.
Yeah, we don't take our trash there.
No. That's what I was going to ask you. Where does that go?
Ontario County landfill right now.
Okay.
Primarily, yep.
Cool. All right, that's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike. Henry?
Yes. Thanks, Bob. I watched the meeting presentation, and Dan asked a question about the numbers and how we're doing this for 1 year. And not for all 5 years. And then Mike, so this is just, so the 5-year layout is just for budgeting purposes only.
Yeah.
We're not
it's
bound.
For, it's for anticipating what could happen over time so that, for example, we can not see the fee increase, decrease. And we've been doing this for as long as I've been in my position because to be prudent at financing, and really I recommend it for any department, to look ahead, see what the risks and the unknowns are, come up with what the variables could be and the assumptions, which we've done but we haven't provided at this time. And we will do that with the new F&I committee next year, is critical so that we don't make mistakes and we can be inclusive. And then when it comes time, you know, when things get more stable and we're looking at some other programs, we can decide how we're going to manage. And we will be putting together, there's been a COVID wait, but we will be providing a new 10-year solid waste plan that's going to have requirements, and we can calculate what the diversion rate's going to be and what those cost implications are.
So has the rate gone down in the last 10 years?
The diversion rate has gone up. We are reducing more waste.
Have the fees gone down?
No. No, because we've had cost increases. Remember, not too long ago, we had a very large increase in the recycling collection cost with the next bid. And we had $500,000 in expenses. Okay. So overall, things don't go down, they go up.
Barbara, I think we have seen reductions in the fee, even though they've gone up, overall. They've been cut a dollar, for example. I think.
Oh, yeah. We did go
from $3.
Yeah. We did a while ago, yes. All right. And that was before the recycling revenue started to plummet more than 5 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Martha.
Barb, you mentioned that this contract includes a living wage to be paid by all employees. At the committee, you said that there was a, you compared it to the last contract where we added it on, and you said you had, were able to figure out an increment of like how much this contract could be attributed to that living wage. Do you remember how much?
Yeah, I didn't take it any further, but I do know it's around $165,000, which I mentioned at the last time because I did ask that question during negotiations.
And that's per year, right?
Per year.
$165,000. And in the rest,
that's about $3 on the annual fee, just so you know.
Okay, thanks. That helps to make it real concrete. And in the resolution, this increases the 2021 number to 70. We had already, in our budget, we had been talking about increasing it to 65,
mm-hmm.
60. So kind of the extra amount related to this new contract is $5 for 20.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does say. By the way, you all have information in great detail in your packet, just if you want to look back at that information.
Yep.
Thank you.
Me too. All right. Thank you, Barb, again. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, Mike. Let's vote on this resolution. It was moved and seconded.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Dan Corman?
Yes.
Blaine?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Arthur Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 no.
Thank you.
It carries unanimously. Thank you, and thank you for the education you do with our public so they understand.
And please, if you feel that we need to do a better job at letting people know, don't hesitate to email me or make mention to either Jason or I, and we'll be happy to accommodate that request.
Wonderful. Will do. All right.
Fernando just joined us. I have to pick up his resolution.
Who?
Fernando.
All right. If we can get through this real fast, I promise you you'll get a break. We have Fernando de Aragon, who's also here with us, waiting for a resolution out of
housing resolution.
Out of HUD. Anna, do you want to move that resolution?
Yes, I will.
Resolution K.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. Moved by Anna, seconded by Mike Lane. If you don't mind just reading the title, Anna, so people know what we're voting on.
Correct. Affirming Ithaca Tompkins County Transportation Council recommendation to increase the ITCTC staff director's salary. That's ID 9680. Can I move that?
Thank you very much. Discussion on this? Martha?
Thank you. I emailed everybody this afternoon that I had checked with Fernando that this salary and all salaries and benefits, all costs of the to have the Transportation Council are paid by a federal grant that we've had since 1992. That date is in the first whereas. I want just to make sure it was clear that it's federal money. So he said the following was accurate, so I'd like to propose it as an amendment as a second whereas. Whereas expenses for the ITCTC, including all salaries and fringes, are paid through a federal grant program.
Not as friendly. We talked about it in committee.
That's friendly.
Okay.
All right. We're being friendly, and that's accurate. Is that correct, Fernando, on the there? Are you nodding at me, Fernando and Anna?
Yes.
Okay. He's nodding. Thank you very much. Any other discussion? All right, let's vote on this one.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Zed Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Less than the Dean Claiborne?
Yes. 14 ayes, 0 noes. That carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Thank you, Fernanda, for hanging in there.
Thank you.
It is 7:51. We are going to take a break at this point. Be back here at 8 o'clock sharp to go. Thank you. Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back. We're just getting our technical stuff together here. Let's move on. I need to know that I have folks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Let me know you're there. Rick, 7, 8. Beautiful. Thank you. I have a quorum that I can move on. We're at consent agenda. Consent agenda. Resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group, unless any member of the legislature requests that a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of standing or special committee. The appointments to advisory board, I have a whole wash of them, and I will read through them as quickly as I can. Under Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Air Services Board, terms to expire December 31st, 2023. Appointments of Larry Baum and David Punty, both are at-large representatives. From the Public Safety Committee, Emergency Response and Oversight Committee, Eric Dauber, New York State Police Representative, no set term. Julie Holcomb, City of Ithaca Clerk Representative, no set term. And Jennifer Olin, Tompkins County Sheriff Department Representative, no set term. Stub DWI Advisory Board, Stacy Kangalasi Mike, Alcoholism Council Representative, term expires 31st of December 2023. Criminal Justice Advisory Alternatives Incarceration Board, Bridget Nugent, Youth Services Department Representative, term expires 31st of December 2023. ABIR, Advisory Board and Indigent Representation, term expires December 31st of 2023. Joseph Kirby, Suzanne V. Rain, Esquire, and Aubrey Hesnecker. From Health and Human Services Committee, Community Mental Health Services Board, Amanda Cahy. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Thank you. Term expires December 31st, 2022. Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee. From that committee, on the Water Resources Council, Arthur Talk, Business and Industry Representative. Term expires December 31st, 2021. Elizabeth Thomas, Recreation Representative. Term expires December 31, 2022, and Annie Bastoni, at-large representative. Term expires December 31, 2022. Other terms that are expiring December 31, 2023, Elizabeth Cameron, environmental health representative. A. Faye Benson, Agriculture Representative. Linda Wagenet, At-Large Representative. Michelle Henry, Environmental Management Council Representative. Sharon Anderson, Cooperative Extension Representative. Kristen Hychuk, am I pronouncing that right? Hychuka?
Hychuka. Hychuka. Hychuka.
Okay, I will say Hitchka. Thank you, Mike. Municipal representative. Stephanie Redman, at-large representative. A few more. Environmental Management Council, term expired December 31st, 2022. Joey Diana Gates, at-large. Susan Riley, at-large representative. Andra Benson, Town of Lansing representative. Agriculture and Farmland Protection Board, term expires December 31, 2024. Norman Davidson, farmer representative, and George P. Fleming, farmer representative as well.
That's John P. Fleming.
John P. Fleming. What did I say?
George.
John. I think George is a movie star. Planning Advisory Board. Terms expire December 31, 2023. Leslie Schill, education representative. Fernando de Argon, transportation representative. Joseph L. Blows, housing representative. Andrew Zepp, land preservation, public land management representative. And Heather McDaniel, economic development representative. Those are all advisory board appointments on the consent agenda. Resolutions on the consent agenda from Government Operations Committee. Resolution A, date of 2021 organizational meeting, ID 9689. From Public Safety, Resolution B, authorization to accept the grant, Department of Emergency Response, ID 9719. From Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Resolution C, approving completed tax rolls and directing the executing and delivery of warrants, ID 9685. Resolution D, town and city budgets and printing of tax rolls, ID 9686. Resolution E, authorization for finance director to make year-end transfers, appropriations, and budget adjustments as required, ID 9687. Resolution F, authorization to sign drafts, meaning checks, county administrator, ID 9688, and no, Jason, they cannot be checks made out of dummies. Resolution G, delegating to the finance director of the county of Tompkins, New York, the power to authorize the issuance of and to sell $10 million revenue anticipation notes of said county in anticipation of receipt of state aid during the fiscal year of said county commencing January 1, 2021. ID 9690. Resolution 8, authorization to disperse funds, county administration, ID 9692. And Resolution I, authorization to participate in various contracts let by any government entity of the United States of America, ID 9695. All the resolutions on consent agenda. May I have a motion to accept the consent agenda moved by Amanda Champion, seconded by Deb Dawson. All in favor of the consent agenda. Here we go.
Sean Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deb Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Ian Klein?
Yes.
Ian Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Leslie McBain Clairborn?
Yes.
49, Sarah.
Consent agenda carries. One quick thing I forgot under my chair's report is a reminder to please send in your United Way pledge forms if you do contribute to United Way to Betty by December 18th. We'd love for that to happen. To get 100% contribution from Tompkins County would be wonderful. All right, standing and special committee reports, beginning with Governor Doc.
Excuse me, are they in our mailboxes downtown?
I just got this out of my mailbox, but I know they were also emailed, I believe. The form itself was also in the email. So you, if you have a printer at home, you can print it out. If not, they're in your mailboxes.
All right, thank you.
Sure thing. Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion Chair.
Thank you, Leslin. Government Operations has not met since our last meeting. We will be meeting on this coming Thursday, December 3rd at 1:45 p.m. We're going to have a bunch of standard year-end resolutions that we go through every year. We're also going to talk about and have a resolution about the rules of the legislature, rule number 4. So we did talk, we kind of went through that at our last meeting, and now we're going to have a resolution to vote on some changes. If that passes, that will then come before the full legislature. On the agenda, we are also going to have a summary of 2020 conferences attended by legislators and their expenses. This is something that we changed in the rules of the legislature last year, and that part of that was to be given a report at the end of each year about what conference money that folks used. I have no idea if anyone's used any money. I'm pretty sure no one's traveled anywhere. So it might be a very short report. So that's all I have for a report. I do have a resolution.
Any questions on the report? Go ahead.
All right. So the resolution is adoption of local law number C of 2020, a local law amending section 205 and section 209 of Article 2 of the Tompkins County Charter, and I would move that.
May I have a second, please? Second by Dan Klein, and we have a public hearing on this afternoon.
Yeah, and I would say, just to explain again in case folks forgot, this is, again, we're just changing a few parts of the charter to match what the legislature already voted on several months ago in our rules of the legislature. So we want them to be in agreement.
Thank you very much. Let's vote.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Leslin McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you very much. That carries unanimously. Anything else, Amanda?
Nope. Thank you.
No. All right. Show up on Thursday if you want to participate. Planning, Energy and Environmental Policy Committee, Deb Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had a robust discussion of the county greenhouse gas emissions inventory, as well as the Green Fleet Framework. We were lucky to have Ann Corman with us so that we could really talk about those cars and the charging infrastructure that we're putting in. We also heard from Barb Ekstrom about the recycling department's plans for education on reusable bags and outreach. We discussed the Public Service Commission's determination on the long-pending NYSEG rate case. For those of you who may not have been paying attention to this, the PSC gave the electric side approximately 2% per year rate increase over 3 years, which is cumulative, but not nearly as much as the 20-some percent that they had initially asked for. Unfortunately, what this means is simply that that rate increase that was denied will get plowed back into a future rate increase case, and we can fight about this all over again. But given the pandemic and the economic impact it's had on a lot of the local ratepayers, this is a pretty good solution for the time being. We did not have time left over to discuss the Green Workforce Report.
Thank you, Deborah. Questions? Amanda, and then Martha.
I don't have a question. I just wanted to let everyone know that the Cornell Cooperative Extension is having its annual meeting on December 15th at 9 a.m. They really like those early morning things. So the Zoom information, if you want to come, everyone is welcome. Anyone in the community can come. The information is on their website. And I believe part of I don't think it's going to be a presentation. It's going to be a little bit more of a discussion and trying to get community input on some strategic planning ideas, I think. So everyone's welcome.
Thank you. Martha?
Thanks. Just a quick, I guess, announcement that's related to PEAK. Deborah and I have been tracking some of the advisory panel meetings and the Climate Action Council meetings of the CLCPA, the state initiative. This Thursday is a meeting with local government officials, meeting with the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel. And I was one of 20 local officials chosen to be on this round table. That's this Thursday at 1:30. And I think I may have sent, I'm not sure if I sent that around to folks, but just wanted to point that out, that finally there's at least this little bit of an official role for local government officials to weigh in to this one panel. So that's this Thursday.
Thanks, Martha. Anything else? Anything else, Deborah? All right. Thank you very much. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslin. Budget, Capital, and Personnel has not met since the last legislature meeting. Our next meeting is Monday, December 14th at 3 o'clock. And we'll be talking, we hope to have time to talk about the rollover policy, but Jason may have other ideas for us. So that's it.
Thank you. Thank you. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Ann Corman, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have not met since our last legislative meeting, but we are meeting tomorrow, and that's at 3:30. So please feel free to join us. On our agenda tomorrow is, why does the window disappear when you? Okay, just had that up. Okay, here it is. Dr. Clark is going to be talking about the workforce reading and discussion program that will be getting underway in January. And the first book is titled How to Be an Anti-Racist, which is one of the best books out there. So if you can't be in the discussion program, I encourage everybody to pick it up. We'll also be getting an update from Deanna Carithers on the Facing Race Conference, but I intend for that to be a discussion for anybody that has gone to it. So feel free to attend if you've gone to the conference or you want to hear some insights that people have learned. I'll just state one of mine real quick, is that going forward, we can look at this time, and I've said a little bit about this before, but we can look at this as a pivotal time that, you know, everything's upset. Everything is, and a lot of things are off the table. So as we start to put, you know, assemble our community back together, as we start to, reboot our economies, that's the ideal time actually to think about the people most affected by this, by the coronavirus, which is women, people of color, single parents are a few of the categories, and a lot of people are also essential and frontline workers. And so if you fall into more than one of those categories, you were more affected by the virus. And people were affected not just now. People sometimes think, well, you know, as it goes on, but a lot of these people were affected immediately in March and April, whether they had to stop working because they had kids at home that they had to suddenly teach, or they had the virus and they couldn't work, or they didn't have a job. So we need to really think about this in every single thing that we do, just the same as we think about money. Like, can we afford it? We need to think about people. So if we thought about each thing that we do, that we think about people that are affected and people that need to be considered during each thing, just as we think about money, and we can do the two things together. A lot of times, when you're recovering from something, you might think, well, only the priority is to get our financials back in order. But it's not. We're serving these people. We need to help the community. We don't want to take a step back and make inequity even worse than it was before. So thanks for letting me talk about that. Other things on our agenda are reimagining a public safety update, also an update about Team Jedi, the Justice, Equity, and Diversity Initiative, and the Diversity Consortium of Tompkins County we'll be talking about. And I was lucky to go to my first meeting with that group. And Dr. Clark will also be talking about the recent forum on racial equity, and not on our agenda, but I talked to Kit Kephart at DSS, and she's going to give us an update on Code Blue and the shelter, because that also affects people who are most vulnerable in our community. And I'm not sure if I missed anything else. Henry, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, although I'm going to a GARE conference, G-A-R-E,
right,
tomorrow, which I also noticed that they, and I saw this before, they have a racial equity tool, which basically does what you say, Anne, is looks at decisions on a racial basis. So hopefully Deanna can get us more involved with that process and hopefully bring a racial equity toolkit to our legislature.
That would be great, because, you know, we don't expect, I think I can speak for most people involved in this type of work. We don't expect things people, you know, 180 or automatically, you know how to do this. We need training in how to do this also. Thank you, Henry.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Ann. Any questions for Ann? All right. Moving on. Tompkins Intergovernmental Relations Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslin. We've not met since the last legislature meeting. We are meeting tomorrow at 11:30. And we won't have Amanda Spellacy this time, but we will be meeting Jared Jones, who is in Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's office. He's the state director. He's taking the place of Sarah Clark, who was elected to the New York State Assembly. And Anna will bump into her in the, you know, virtual hallways or something. So we'll meet Jared. we have Charlie Krasansky and Zoe Nelson also from Cornell offering the Albany update. And Anna will be talking about her top priorities for, the first 100 days, right, Anna? The first year or something like that. I want to really encourage the committee members and anybody else to read what's in the packet, the NYSEC report for recommendations for overcoming this current state and local budget crisis. A lot of it is quite technical stuff about Medicaid and public safety, very technical program regulations, but it's quite an education for us. But I also want us to focus on what priorities we might really want to bring to Albany. I think the committee will try to hone some messages and actually start planning some virtual lobbying with our Albany lawmakers. So this is an important step to really understand what NYSAC has been suggesting. And then I know we'll talk a lot about the federal COVID relief options. There's a new bill that was presented today for $908 billion. So hoping to hear more about that, the chances for that, and how it might fare in Washington. So should be an interesting agenda. That's what I've got.
Thank you, Martha. Any questions for Martha? Deborah.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Martha, I just wanted to let you know, I got an email today. I'm sure Dan got the same email as well, from Rick Snyder, our financial officer at TCAT. Well, apparently we got our latest quarter of STOA, which was on this whole harmless deal. So it was keyed to last year's ridership and not this year's ridership, but we only got 80.2% of what we could have expected if we had received the entire hold harmless amount, which I think is a pretty good sign that the 20% cut in state aid is soon to be upon us, and we should take that into account in our lobbying and our planning.
Mm-hmm. Well, the governor has been tying this withholding of 20% to the prospects of federal aid.
Yep.
So we might by January still not know if there's any kind of state and local aid. I understand state and local is in this new bill by Manchin and Collins that was rolled out today. Don't remember the exact amount, but I think we. Realistic and pretty much expecting the worst, that 20% is not going to be coming, because I doubt there's any prospect of getting as much state aid as the governor says he would need to restore those funds.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else? All right. Okay. Housing and Economic Development Committee, Anna Kellis, Chair.
Hello, all. We are meeting, as I said earlier, on the 8th. This is the last meeting of the year, and nostalgically, my last meeting, committee meeting for the legislature. We have several reports and things that will be touched on for this meeting. One I already brought up, which is the consideration of the resolution that I sent to you earlier this evening concerning a labor on the IT.
Can't hear you, Anna.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
It's so odd. I don't know why my speaker goes in and out. So the first one of the things that will be considered is the resolution that I sent to everyone, which is the consideration of a labor seat on the IDA. That resolution was sent to everyone earlier tonight. We also have what I think will be a dynamic presentation from Ithaca Area Economic Development, previously known as Tompkins County Area Development, on the enhanced energy policy of the IDA that will be presented. And we also have approval of bylaws of the Strategic Tourism Planning Board. So that is on the 8th, December 8th at 10 a.m. That is a Tuesday.
All right. Questions for Anna? Please show up at her last meeting and heckle her, please.
Counting on it.
That's a direct request. Thank you, Anna. Downtown Facilities Committee, Dave McKenna, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Downtown Facilities has not met since our last meeting, and we will be meeting on December 10th.
December 10th. Thank you, Dave.
What time?
Time?
4 o'clock.
4 p.m. Thank you much, Lee. Any questions for Dave? Moving on. Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Public Safety Committee met on November 19th, and we had a very good discussion of the progress of the police reform project, the task groups that are working on the various elements. It does appear there's a lot of work underway right now in getting public comment, and it seems to be getting a very broad range of people coming forward to talk about policing in our community. So I'm very happy that it's getting the attention that it really deserves. We also had a report from CARS, Cuga Addiction Recovery Services, on their methadone program. They got a state license, I believe it was last January. It seems like a very long time ago, but it was, I think, right at the beginning of this year for 50 slots, and they have to go by those increments. And they are now up to 80 people. So wow. This is a service that has really is being used in our community. And I believe that it has had some impact on why we have not seen a rise in overdose deaths. That what the executive director seemed to indicate was that there were several people coming in who are on other substances, and methadone apparently is more effective. But this seems to be a real positive in our community. It was great to get the report. And I would mention our jail population is at 33 with two board outs. That's a very, very low number. Mm-hmm. I believe there were a whole bunch of state ready individuals from our last report. So we've come down pretty substantially, but we are maintaining a very low number, whether that's related to COVID and it'll go back up when we all get vaccinated. I don't know, but we have certainly set some real records this year. Our next meeting will not be on Thursday. It's going to be on Tuesday, December 15th at 1:00. There was a conflict with TCOG, and so we moved our meeting to accommodate them. So that's Tuesday, 12:15 at 1:00. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right.
Oh, I do have a resolution. I apologize. I would move Resolution L, Document ID 9639, Appropriation from Contingent Fund, Replacement Pay, Reimbursement, Sheriff's Office.
I have a second, please. Seconded by Martha Robertson. Discussion. Let's vote on the resolution. And, Rich, I think that Mike has a comment or question for you on your presentation. Our committee report.
Okay.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Mori?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
All right, on the committee report, questions for Rich.
Rich, I wondered, you mentioned that there are two board outs. We aren't back to boarding out the women again, are we?
I think that might be the case, Mike. I'm not certain on that, but that seems likely that there were only two women in our jail, which is a great thing that we're that low. But at that number, it does not make sense to open up a whole section of the jail. But, Jason, maybe you know.
Yes, you're right, Rich. The other challenge that we're having was an adequate number of female correction officers available. We ran into, I think, a disability or two, and so we didn't have adequate staffing numbers to do so. So board out was the only option.
Well, I think it's something we need to struggle to avoid because often these the women may have children or family, and if you board them out to Tioga or Schuyler or wherever, it's very hard for them to be in contact and have visitation.
We agree.
Mike, I certainly agree with you, and that's, as you know, been at the heart of a lot of our policy on trying to reduce our jail numbers, that we wanted to have adequate rooms so that we would avoid board outs, because you take people away from their family, their friends, their support structure, and their counsel, it just makes it much harder for them. And of course, because we have a very different system of alternatives to incarceration and support programs for people in jail and as they leave, we want to try to keep them here so that we are having them work within our system. So I agree entirely.
Thanks.
Thank you for raising that, Mike. Thank you. Anything else for Rich? Or anything else from you, Rich? No? All right.
Thank you very much.
All right, we'll move on. Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
Thank you very much. We met this afternoon for about 42 seconds and approved our advisory board appointments that we also approved tonight in the legislature meeting. Our next meeting will be December 21st at 1 p.m.
Questions at the end.
Not a question. I just want to report on something. Is that our county office for the aging had reason to believe that they were going to be spared from that 20% New York State cut. However, about a week and a half ago, they found out that that was not the case. They are also getting cut along with everybody else. So I just wanted to pass it along.
Thank you for that sunshiny news, Dan. It's coming. It's coming. Deb Dawson.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I forgot to mention, I'm reminded by everyone else rescheduling their December meetings. This month we'll be meeting on Wednesday, the 23rd of December at 10:30.
Thank you, Deborah. There will be holiday cookies. Virtual.
Bring your own.
You're meeting on the 23rd. You better be sending eggnog and cookies to people's houses. All
it's
right.
Better than the 28th.
All right. Thank you very much. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Lane. Chair, I think.
Yes. I started it before, of course, and we got into the discussion about the recycling, which was what we spent most of our committee meeting on. But I did want to mention also that we heard from Jason Molino and Arel Lamaro about the Tompkins County Green Facilities Energy Study and how we will be moving forward to try to make our buildings more energy efficient and green. And that's something that this legislature has voted to do and to spend capital on, and we will be having some reports on that as we go along. This study will help us, Jason told us, and Arel, be in a better position to obtain grant funding to help us with those initiatives. So I wanted to say that, and wanted to mention that our next meeting is going to be Thursday, December 17th at 9 o'clock in the morning. And anything you wanted to mention?
I think you got it all. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much, committee chairs. I chair the committee of the community, and Mike Sigler just reminded me with a screenshot that the State Theater, like many of our businesses out there trying to hustle to stay alive, and they are having a virtual concert tonight and, encouraging people to, on Giving Tuesday, this is Giving Tuesday. Up until midnight, I think you can give, you can donate. So please do find your favorite charity or place you know is struggling and give. The State Theater is one of those places, trying to keep the doors open, at least stay alive. Shauna and I did a couple of videos just encouraging people to support them. You can save your seat for $100 in the kitchen theater or give whatever you can. So please, it's Giving Tuesday, just a reminder, to reach into your pocketbooks, those of you who can afford it, because we have so many other people who can't and who will depend on the support that we give. Thank you very much. We have an executive session, so I need a motion to go. Oh, no, minutes. I forgot the minutes. Sorry. I was hurrying to go home. I got the minutes. Minutes of previous meetings. We have November 5th, November 10th, and November 17th.
Can we move them all at once, Madam Chair?
Are you moving all of them, Annie? I saw Annie first.
Yes, okay. I'm moving all of them together.
All right. Deborah, are you seconding all of them?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Discussion on the minutes. Martha, I see you. She go.
I'll let Anna go. I think it's her comment.
So a question. I think it's a typo on the November 5th minutes. It shows me arriving at 9:50 p.m.
Okay, now I'm confused. Who's talking?
Anna was talking.
Oh. All right. Kathy will find it and correct it.
Great. That is the only thing. Thank you, Martha, for the catch.
Yeah.
That was it? Oh, okay. All right. So let's vote on the minutes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Mori?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you very much. That carries. Now we can entertain a motion to go into executive session, moved by Deb Dawson, seconded by Anna Kellis, for the purposes of discussing a personnel matter relating to a specific person. We'll take a short break while we shut things down and say goodnight to those who need to leave.
We have to vote.
Oh, sorry. We have to vote to go into executive session.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Ray Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Mori?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Sigler?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Now, the carries, we're heading into executive session. Now we'll take a quick moment while we get things shut down.